Good afternoon. I am going to start by talking slowly and hoping to encourage everyone to let me know if they cannot hear me in any way. All of our sound connections have been checked, as have yours been prior to beginning today's session. So I'll ask the marshal just to call us in to begin, and then I'll have a few remarks before the first case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradford, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Diane B. Bradford presiding. Now calling State of Minnesota versus Paul Jonathan Lindahl.
Right. And so the first matter on our calendar today is State versus Lindahl. And I see that counsel are here and present. I know that you've already checked your connections and received some instructions on what to do if we should lose connection during the course of this argument. But hopefully that won't happen. And we are, of course, looking forward to proceeding and hearing your arguments today. I have just a few quick reminders. I know that you're used to appearing in front of us and probably have done so multiple times, even under this current Zoom format. But just so that you are aware, our procedures are really the same as they were in a courtroom. We're just seeing you in a different setting. And so we ask you to follow those procedures and, of course, ask questions if you have them. In doing so, please identify yourself for the record before you start your remarks, as well as the client that you're representing. That's important. These proceedings are recorded, and that recording is made available later on our website. In addition, I just would ask you to keep your eye on the clock. The 15 minutes should go down. It should be visible to you now, and keep your eye on that. It does tend to go quickly. We do look forward to hearing your argument today. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed. So counsel for appellant, when you're ready, please go ahead.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jill Brisbois, B-R-I-S-B-O-I-S, and I have the pleasure of representing Paul Lindahl, the appellant in this case. I want to start my argument by emphasizing that in respondents' briefing, they admit that Jacob Thomas sexually assaulted I.I.L. This court must reverse Mr. Lindahl's criminal convictions for criminal sexual conduct and malicious punishment of a child because the district court denied him the ability to present a complete defense by precluding him from presenting alternative perpetrator evidence, specifically that Jacob Thomas committed those offenses, and it limited Mr. Lindahl or the appellant from cross-examining Jacob Thomas on the sole issue he was called to testify about at trial. My hope is to address all three arguments. If I don't have a chance to get to our expert testimony, I would like to say that I believe that's an incredibly important issue, but I understand I do have limited time today. This case is unique to other alternative perpetrator cases because the underlying allegations are not a solitary incident that happened at a fixed period of time. Nonetheless, Mr. Lindahl presented evidence that had an inherent tendency to connect Jacob Thomas to the abuse of I.I.L., and all of that evidence was admissible at trial.
Counsel, if I can interrupt just to get your refresher, if you could refresh me a little bit, what does the charge in the complaint say in terms of time frame?
The first degree criminal sexual
Correct.
Conduct and the second degree criminal sexual conduct. The charge, I believe it's going to be August of 2013 to August of, or it may have been October of 2017. I apologize. There was a number of criminal complaints that were issued in this case, but I believe that was the final complaint. Does that answer the court's question?
Yes, thank you.
And that was, and I also will say the malicious punishment of the child may have been in more broad range as well. That may have gone back to the point of time when I.I.L. would have been 4 years old, which would have been August of 2011. It is the position of the appellant that there was an overwhelming amount of evidence that from the period of time when Bella or I.I.L. was one to when she was seven, she was sexually abused and physically abused by her brother, Jacob Thomas. Therefore, there is an inherent tendency to connect the later accusations of abuse to Jacob Thomas as well. The purpose of the inherent tendency.
Ms. Brisbois, let me ask you this. Why is that so, given that we seem to be dealing with different periods of time as between Mr. Thomas's acts and your client's acts, and also different kind of conduct?
Sure. So, you know, I'll point the court back to if this was a criminal prosecution, in any criminal prosecution, the state is permitted to charge an extended period of time, and they're not necessarily required to prove a specific date. Similarly speaking, they're not always required to prove the type of penetration. So six jurors could agree that the penetration was digital penetration. Another six jurors could agree that there was oral penetration. And so the fact that we're dealing with this extended period of time and different accusations about the type of penetration is irrelevant, because within the criminal prosecution, the state isn't always required to say it was this type of penetration and it happened on this particular day. But going back to the timeline, that is important. From the time that IIL was won up until the age of 7, people were raising concerns that Jacob Thomas was sexually abusing her. It's important to note that the first investigation that was conducted by the Scott County Attorney's Office, I apologize, not Scott County, Shakopee Police Department, began when Bella was 7. That's the time period that the state uses to start charging it. But the first time she was interviewed about allegations was when she was 7, when somebody was raising an issue. And so the fact that there's a group of people that say, when Bella's 1 to 4, I saw Jacob Thomas sexually assaulting her, I heard Jacob Thomas admitting to it, we still have people years later saying, we have a problem here, law enforcement, please do something about that. And so the fact that this wasn't observed over that full 7-year period of time should be irrelevant. The fact remains that this kid, Jacob Thomas, was continuously near Bella, living with Bella, and still lives with Bella to this day. And
Ms. Brisbois, are you saying that there's something about the nature of these charges that we should look at differently than, say, a series of robberies, for example? And if you have someone, let's say someone named Jacob who is investigated for committing a series of robberies in, let's say, a 3-year period of time, and then there's someone else who's being charged with additional robberies of the same store outside that initial period of time, my guess is that you would agree that the alternative perpetrator defense would not apply there, because you're looking at two different windows of time. And are you saying then that there's something distinct or different about the nature of these charges that would allow us to put aside the way we've applied alternative perpetrator in the past, which is limited to the charged offense?
Sure. You know, and it goes back to the fact that we, meaning the criminal justice system, the rules of criminal procedure and the statutes, treat allegations of not only sexual assault, but physical assault much differently than we treat other types of crimes, such as robberies, for example. That is why the state of Minnesota is permitted to charge out these extended period of time when they don't have precise dates. Typically, when there's a robbery, you're going to have somebody immediately reporting or reporting shortly thereafter. And as we learned through the testimony of Barbara Kern-Pia, that isn't necessarily true in cases of abuse, whether it's physical, sexual, or mental abuse. And so I think there is a fundamental distinction between the court's example and the types of charges that we're dealing here. But I do appreciate trying to draw out that difference. But perhaps in that case, you know, that the court just, or the scenario the court proposed, I may be trying to raise the alternative perpetrator defense, but I would have to have more information about it. But again, I just want to say, we always treat these types of cases differently for that reason. Corroboration isn't required in criminal sexual conduct cases. The state gets to use these extended periods of time, and that is important in this situation.
So, counsel, I just want to follow up briefly, because, you know, even if I agree with you that the same sort of view that has been accorded to the prosecution should be accorded to the defense of the alternative perpetrator scenario. So just let's assume I agree with you. I'm not aware of case law that says what you're saying, but go right ahead and we'll accept it for the moment. I'm still struggling with your record in this case. So you argued earlier that you believe that the record established that Thomas sexually abused IL during the time frame when she was ages 4 to 7. Now that's very different from what the district court found, and it's different from what I see when I look at the record. So would you let me know what you think your strongest evidence is that you would have in fact proven sexual abuse by Thomas in that time frame?
I apologize for interrupting.
No, go ahead.
It's difficult because we were not permitted to make the record.
I struggle with that one because you did a pretty good job of laying out and presenting, making an offer of proof, and the district court made pretty detailed findings as to what that offer of proof was. So to the extent you were cut off of anything, you could have supplemented your record, right?
What we had always offered and what we always had available was to bring these people into court. These people were subpoenaed witnesses that were going to come in and testify. We were not going to rely upon that police report. We were not going to rely upon the investigators that investigated this case. We were going to bring these people into court to testify. Had the court said, Ms. Brisbois, I want to set a hearing so I can hear from these people, I would have done that. I told the court that I would do that. Just tell me when and where. So I guess I made the best record I could with what I had. I introduced the police report. And in that briefing, I said, if the court wants more, please let us know. What happened was on the second day of jury selection, we were told we couldn't present this evidence without making any type of further record. It wasn't until much later that we learned the reasons why we were not able to make that record. But again, I wish I could have made a better record. I would have brought those people in. We had somebody prepared to come from the state of Washington to testify about these things.
So counsel, that's an issue you haven't raised in your appellate brief, that you were somehow prevented from making a record on the alternative perpetrator evidence. Am I right? I don't think that's in front of this court.
I've never raised that issue.
Okay. All right. So let's just take the record that you do have and acknowledge for the moment that you would have loved to have made a better record within the record that you do have. Mm-hmm. What do I have to look at to really bring the timelines of the sexual abuse for these two different parties, Thomas and Lindahl, to bring them in the same time frame? Because I don't see it. So you need to help me out.
Sure. So you have the Shakopee law enforcement record. I think it's referred to as SLER. Within that record, it talks about Emmett O'Byrne observing Jacob Thomas sexually abusing IIL starting at the age of 1, observing it, I believe, up until the age or till 2011, potentially when IIL was 4. You have Colleen Geiger witnessing this abuse, I think she says from 2008 to 2012. Within that period of time, you hear an admission. You have
So hearing Mr. Thomas admit something isn't the same as proving the time frame in which he did it, is it? I mean, it depends on the admission, of course, but it's not necessarily the same thing. Right.
Correct. And then we have a third witness against hearing Mr. Thomas admit to it. Then I would further point you to the Corner House transcript. On page 7 of the Corner House transcript, IIL, in response to Barbara Kern's Pia's question, which was, why are you here today? There's, you know, some questions. And she says, I was sexually abused since I was 4. Mm-hmm. That age of 4 is within that time range that is established in that SLER report. And so that's what gives you that timeline based on the record that I have presented up until this point.
Okay.
Can I move on from alternative perpetrator?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. Obviously an important issue, but I want to touch briefly on the confrontation issue. When I say Spriegel, I mean Spriegel and 63420, but I'm just shortening it down for purposes of this mm-hmm. argument. Jacob Thomas was a Spriegel witness. He was there to testify about one thing, and the appellant, Mr. Lindahl, was prohibited from questioning him about that one thing. The court directed the state to ask very leading and limited questions so that no door was opened up for us to be able to cross-examine him. This court is fully aware of what satisfies the confrontation clause.
Let me jump in because I know you're running out of time, so I want to be very precise with the question. It seemed to me that you're arguing Bias is always relevant, and there's case law that supports that, and that you were prevented from asking questions specifically about bias. And so the first question I have, if that's the case, is you weren't prevented from arguing or asking questions about any bias that would stem from the physical abuse perpetrated against Jacob. In other words, why does Jacob want to lie? If he wants to lie because he was beaten with a belt, then you did have that option, right?
We had that option to argue that, but again, it would have been a flimsy way to try and argue that.
No, I'm just trying to tease out the different things that might create the bias here. And it seems like the part that you wanted to ask that you weren't allowed to ask about was bias, that Jacob wanted to lie, not because he was beaten with a belt, but because Lindahl believed that Jacob had sexually molested ILL. And that's the motive to lie, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And the bias that Jacob has. Again, we have a situation where the other brother, AHL, was permitted to testify that Mr. Lindahl, and I don't know if you could, this is the motion that AHL was making, that Mr. Lindahl had his arm behind his back like that. We were able to question AHL about why that happened. Mr. Lindahl was able to testify about why that happened. We were not able to do any of that with Mr. Thomas.
Well, I mean, obviously that's because of the district court's ruling on the alternative perpetrator. It gets back to that, does it not?
It is, that was the influencer for why the judge made that ruling. In any other circumstance, that testimony would have come in because it's relevant cross-examination as to why did this alleged abuse happen? Is there a good reason? We were talking about malicious punishment of a child. There are defenses to that particular charge, and we weren't able to in any way defend it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And with that, I think we're ready to turn to respondents' arguments. So, counsel, you can proceed when you are ready.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota. I will largely rest on the brief, but certainly take any questions from the court. I will start by simply where we left off. The court did not prevent the defense from asking Ashton or AHL why he was assaulted. The defense was that he wasn't assaulted at all. So it's true that Lindahl never asked Ashton why he was abused, and that was because when Lindahl testified, he testified that none of this happened. He never hit Ashton with a bow. He never raised his voice. He never hit him at all. So the why, when we're talking about the right to confrontation, is not relevant necessarily, particularly in this case when the defense was fabrication. They've made it up. I didn't do any of this.
But as to Mr. Thomas, I think Mr. Lindahl admitted that he had assaulted him and wanted to explain why. I mean, that's a different situation.
Yeah, I don't think he did admit that he had assaulted him. I don't think he admitted that he did anything. In fact, nobody asked him anything about Mr. Thomas when he testified at trial. And it was
counsel, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I thought the offer of proof that was made, and this was, you know, during the course of discussions about the scope of Mr. Thomas's testimony when I went on the stand, I thought that the offer of proof by the defense is that Mr. Lindahl, if allowed, Mr. Lindahl would get on the stand and say that the reason that he beat Thomas was because he believed that Thomas had been abusing IL.
That is correct. That is what he said, and that's what his attorneys said in discussing this issue prior to the testimony.
So what? So then I guess I'm not quite following you. So why would the defendant then be unable to probe? When alternative perpetrator isn't an issue, they normally would be able to probe bias, right, of Mr. Thomas.
They would. I'm not sure how that would, though, show bias. And that's what the district court found. I mean, the reason why the whipping occurred could have, number one, as the district court found, was irrelevant. But number two, you could have gotten out almost all the information you want about that without having to go into the why it happened. And again, they never asked Ashton why when he testified. They simply denied that any of it had occurred. And as the prosecution pointed out in the discussion with the defense counsel, all of this could have been remediated somewhat by simply sanitizing it. You don't have to go into why necessarily. It could have just been because he was being punished. So it's not, it could have been a defense largely played out with the prejudice limited, but the defense of course wanted to bring in all of it because that was their theory of the case. They wanted to put out there that this had occurred. And the state does not and did not concede and agree that Thomas sexually assaulted his sister. We're not agreeing to that. That was never proved. We're simply, for point of argument at some points in the briefs, addressing it like, if that had happened, this is what would happen. So for instance, with rape shield, you don't have to concede that the rape occurred in order to argue that the rape shield applies. And in fact, it does. So for the alternate perpetrator argument, turning to that briefly, the district court found that there was no inherent tendency to connect Thomas with Lindahl's crimes. And that's important because there is that time gap, and there is a time gap. And I lay that out at page 15 of the state's brief. So the only time that Emmett O'Byrne says that he saw anything happen was once, and that was in 2008. And that was vaginal penetration, digital penetration of the victim's vagina. That was the penetration observed by Emmett O'Byrne in 2008.
How old is ILL in 2008?
In 2008, she would have been either an infant or under 1 year old or to one year. She was born in August of 2007.
And getting to this time gap, there's a difference between what's in the complaint and what the record might show as to when ILL was abused. So at the outer end of the offer of proof relating to the allegations against Jacob, what is the outer end of the time window for that?
For, it would have been, 3 years, I believe.
And what are the years?
2008 plus 3 years. 8, so 9, 10, so through 2011 approximately.
And in the Cornerstone interview, if you could respond to what Ms. Brisbois was saying, where, again, I know that there's the complaint that has a window of time, but if the statement given that is admitted into the record at trial is, I've been abused since I was 4, does that statement window of time, I know it's different from the complaint's window of time, but does the window of time in the statement to Corner House overlap with the allegations against Jacob and the window of time relating to those allegations?
No, not of the sexual abuse. They do not. So Emmett O'Byrne said that.
But what year was she 4?
I'm sorry?
What year did ILL turn 4?
So born in 2007, so 7, 8, 9, 10, so 2010 approximately.
And I thought you said that the outer limit for the allegations, the window of allegations against Jacob was after that. So wouldn't those two windows overlap?
Possibly. If looked at it that way, if you look at the one piece of evidence that came then from that interview.
Right, and I guess that's really the heart of the question. For us, do we look at just the complaint window, the window of time in the complaint, or is there some opening of the door based on testimony of the record on a more expansive window of time?
Even if you have the more expansive window of time, you still don't have an inherent tendency to connect Thomas with Lindahl's crimes. Judge Bradfield was exactly correct. These are not markedly similar crimes. They occurred at a different time. They're different acts, different locations, different age of victim. And Thomas's alleged assault did not connect him with Lindahl's crime because it connected him to some future crime. So the fact that this may have happened when the victim was an infant 3 years old does not in any way exculpate or is exculpatory to the later assaults by Lindahl against his daughter. They're simply completely, they both could have assaulted the victim in this case. It's not exculpatory.
So counsel, would you respond to the argument that appellant's counsel has made? And I admittedly can't point you to case law that would suggest that we would view inherent tendency to connect in the same way, the generous way, that the court system has viewed the prosecutor's ability to offer evidence in child sex abuse crimes and not be have to be tied down to a precise time, date, or means. But, you know, would you respond to the argument and give us your view? Thank you.
I'm unaware of any case law that supports that argument, and that the court noted that. So I think that the district court in this case did not abuse its discretion by the ruling as it did in this case.
So you're just saying we should rest on the fact that there is no case law supporting it in as a way of, say, addressing the inherent tendency to connect from the standpoint of a defense, but the case law does recognize it with regard to appellate review from the prosecutor's sufficiency of the evidence. So why shouldn't there be a connection, counsel? That's what I'm trying to get you to address.
I'm not sure how to answer that question. I'm not sure exactly what the question is exactly.
So you didn't follow the argument? I'm not saying it very well, but appellant's counsel put it in reply brief and has given us an argument today. You don't follow that?
I don't. Okay. And there's no case law that supports it. Therefore, how could the district court have abused its discretion by ruling as it did on the evidence before it with the case law that the court did have?
The standard is inherent tendency to connect, counsel. So it's not as though that is a bright line, right? And we all recognize that because this is an abuse of discretion standard of review. You just said it again. But knowing that, you know, then aren't there some guidelines that we apply? And we, of course, try to apply them fairly.
And there are, and that is a marked similarity. So the case law that's quoted repeatedly.
That usually comes in with the Spriegel evidence, though, doesn't it? The marked
correct,
similarity.
Correct. And that does get transferred over, though. And so it has to mean something, right?
Okay.
Marked similarity certainly is the standard that everybody's held to when it does come to Spriegel. So that's fairly applied to both. And in this case, not only was there not a marked similarity, there wasn't a similarity at all.
And you're talking about means, right, of abuse, of the sexual abuse? Or is there something else?
I'm talking about the means of abuse. I'm talking about the time of abuse. I'm talking about the location of all of the standards that the court looks at. The age of the victim during the time period, that's
different. But if we have the overlap that you just talked to fairly directly, I thought, with Judge Bryan about, so if we have an overlap based on the comment that Aya has been abused since she was 4 years old, then does your argument fall away?
It doesn't, because that was never presented to the district court. So what the district court had was the police reports that were submitted to it. And those police reports do not show overlap.
The statement to Corner House, was that before the district court?
It would have been at some point, but it wasn't argued to the district court in this way by the defense.
So I guess I'm just trying to connect the dots in your argument, and please forgive me if I misstated. Are you suggesting that at some point the courthouse transcript and interview was played for the jury? It became part of this trial record, right?
Correct.
And I haven't reviewed all of it to know which parts went in and which parts didn't go in. So I acknowledge that. But are you suggesting the defense had to renew their request for alternative perpetrator at some point during the course of the trial?
They had to at least make that argument plain to the district court. So if suddenly they're relying on newly discovered evidence or on evidence that the importance of it became newly evident to them, they should have brought that to the attention of the district court so the district court could have done something about it. They didn't. Instead, what the district court had was the police reports that were submitted to it and the arguments based upon that. And that does not show any overlap.
Didn't the defense counsel argue that there was an overlap in time?
They did, and they do now. But based upon what they had, there wasn't.
So what would have been necessary? Is it that they didn't say the way I articulated it, that you have one window of time in the complaint, but another window of time in the statement to Corner House. And if they had said that, then, and the district court had decided to exclude, then you would be conceding error?
No. I still think this should have been excluded as Rape Shield, which I argue in my appellate brief. The district court didn't reach that, but it certainly was barred by, should have been, and this court can affirm on that basis. This would be Rape Shield barred, and it should be Rape Shield barred. And even if there was a brief overlap of time where it could have happened at the same time, or that doesn't necessarily mean that it's an alternative perpetrator. The fact that she was physically assaulted by one person and physically assaulted at another time by another person, and there was overlap, doesn't make it exculpatory. And that's what the district court found here too. Even if they both sexually assaulted this victim, it's not exculpatory. I will briefly jump to the last argument on the expert testimony, and I will simply point out that the briefs focus on really what is footnote 4 of the district court's order with Dr. Reed's testimony. The district court excluded this aspect of Dr. Reed's testimony primarily on Rule 403 and on Rule 702, not on footnote 4. In footnote 4, the court found that, quote, although moot, it would have been excluded for lacking foundational reliability. The primary basis for the exclusion was Rule 403, because it was unfairly confusing and unfairly prejudicial, and Rule 702, it was unhelpful to the jury.
Can you help me out, Mr. Zettler, with that a little bit? I mean, it seems to me that opinions regarding the fact that memory is not pure or intact, I mean, that seems to go beyond a common understanding of memory issues. Why am I wrong about that?
Because the district court made a very common sense ruling on that, in that traumatic events affect your memory. I mean, that is fairly common sense. And beyond that, if you look at what the Dr. Reed actually testified to, she effectively did say exactly that, and I quote her in the state's brief, and the defense attorney argued that in closing arguments. So even though the district court barred it, they presented that defense. Unless the court has any other questions, I would simply ask this court to affirm the district court.
Any other questions from the panel? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much, Mr. Zettler. Okay, the clock has been reset. So Ms. Brisbois, I think we are ready for your final remarks and rebuttal. Thank you.
Very quickly, my August 12, 2019 memorandum, I lay out the timeline very clearly. Within that memorandum, I cite to the fact that in the Corner House interview, IIL says to Barbara Kermpe, I've been sexually abused since I was four, whatever her language is. So the timeline was there for the court in that memorandum where I talked about the alternative perpetrator defense. I want to go back to the court's earlier question for me regarding case law on extended periods of time and modes, I guess, of penetration. I would like to point the court to State versus Tabaka, T-A-B space A-K-A. It is an unpublished opinion from 2017 Westlaw 121-0120. That does talk about the jury not being required to unanimously agree on the means of accomplishing penetration, whether non-consensual penetration occurred vaginally, orally, or by fisting. And so there is some case law support out there.
So that's a sufficiency of the evidence review, counsel, is that right?
This was a unanimity of verdict.
Right.
Yes, correct.
Right, but rather whether the evidence sufficiently established that, right?
Correct. Okay. And so that was going back to the point, which is the state of Minnesota is permitted to charge extended periods of time. They can charge various locations. They can charge various types of penetration. And as long as it's within that extended period of time, they can get a guilty verdict. And so that's just the proposition I'm talking about when it comes to the state is able to get convictions on it. The inherent authority should, or inherent tendency to connect. I would also like to make a distinction between Spriegel standard and the standard to get in an alternative perpetrator defense. State versus Jones, State versus Jones, 678 Northwest 2nd 1. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2004. It really does a good job of talking about how the alternative perpetrator defense works. So they make a distinction between being able to present alternative perpetrator defense, but it isn't always tied to the Spriegel standards. And they make that distinction. There are times where alternative perpetrator evidence is not Spriegel, but still comes in as long as there is that inherent tendency to connect. And so they draw that distinction between those types of things, which is the inherent tendency and the Spriegel clear and convincing evidence standard.
And let me just to put a very precise point on it. You are agreeing that whether it's reverse Spriegel or non-reverse Spriegel, but yes, alternative perpetrator defense, you still, because both are alternative perpetrator, you still have to tie the event that you're seeking to elicit testimony about to, quoting from Jones, the commission of the crime with which the defendant is charged.
Correct. Okay. I agree with that. Yes. Sorry, I'm just going through my notes here. As to Rape Shield, again, I acknowledge that there are instances where Minnesota Rule of Evidence 412 does prohibit a complaining witness's history of abuse from being introduced at trial. However, case law has made it very clear, United States Supreme Court has made it very clear that 412 must yield where the admission is required by the defendant's right to due process and confront their accuser. And so again, this is the situation that we're laying out here, which is this was a fundamental portion of Mr. Lindahl's defense. He was denied the ability to present any type of defense as it relates to the alternative perpetrator, as it relates to memory and cross-examine Jacob Thomas in any meaningful manner. Does the court have any questions for me on expert testimony? Like I said, this is a very important issue to me, and so I want to answer any questions you may have on that.
Well, I don't know if it's a question or observation for you to respond to, but as I read Dr. Reed's testimony, it seems to me that in essence, she was permitted to testify, notwithstanding the district court's prior ruling about multiple factors that contaminate a person's memory. What at the end of the day, what was Dr. Reed not able to testify to?
Memory formation and other factors. So it's not only an investigation that can impact a child's memory, but you know, family, history of trauma. There's a whole litany of things that she talks about that can impact memory. She was able to just talk about the method of investigation, and that was simply it. But as her report lays out, I know it's a lengthy report. There are a lot of other things that do impact a child's memory. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions from the panel? Okay. And I just wanted to pause for a moment. I certainly understand the detail that counsel and the effort that counsel have put into briefing this case, and we very much appreciate it. It was very well briefed and argued. The case is now submitted to us for our decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.